Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor of Cure Talks, joining you from India on Cure Talks' 116th episode. Today we are talking about focal ablation of prostate for treatment of localized prostate cancer. Our prostate cancer talks are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and Prostate Cancer Foundation. Today's panel is talking to Dr. Ara Karamanian, a specialist in MRI-guided focal laser ablation of the prostate, which is a developing new form of treatment for prostate cancer. The panel will discuss the treatment technique in detail and cover categories of patients who are most appropriate candidates for this type of treatment, brief background to the development of the technique, number of physicians with significant experience, unknown side effects, and more. Co-host for the show is Mike Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific and not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. He is a former chairman of the board of the National Organization for Rare Disorders and is a board member of the International Myeloma Foundation. Joining Mike on the panel are prostate cancer advocates Tony Crispino, a 10-year survivor of advanced prostate cancer, in remission now and working with the nation's top researchers as a patient advocate. Jan Manorite, who is caregiver, widow, educator, and advocate for past 15 years. She is currently executive VP of the Prostate Cancer International. Jim Wickstrom. Jim was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2011. He underwent HIFU and has a current PSA of 0.4. A warm welcome to everyone to Cure Talks. Before I hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion, I would like to remind all the people who have dialed in and who are listening to us online that we will be addressing questions sent in towards the end of the discussion. If you have a question you would like to ask, please press 1 on your keypads and we can bring you on air to ask them. You can also email your questions to priya@trialx.com or post a question on curetalks.com. With that, it's over to Mike. Mike, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya, and good evening, everyone, and good evening to you, Dr. Karamanian. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all. What I think we'd like to do is give you about 15 minutes or so to give us some initial background on where you think people are in the use of focal laser ablation today, and a sort of general overview dealing with the different types of FLA, the types of patient who you are seeing, and where we are in the development of this technique, which obviously has potential, but obviously also we're missing a lot of data as yet.
Yes, that is definitely one of the criticisms of any emerging technology. You can't have long-term outcome data until it's been done for a long time. That's obvious. So let me explain sort of where the origin of this is, where the origin of MRI-guided focal laser ablation came from, and then how we got to where we are and where we look to be going. Traditionally, when you do a biopsy in any organ looking for cancer, you use some sort of imaging guidance to see your target and use that to direct a needle into that target. You wouldn't do a blind biopsy of the breasts. You wouldn't do a blind biopsy of the lungs, or you wouldn't do a blind biopsy looking for liver cancer. It's all done with image guidance. Unfortunately, up to very recently, we didn't have a good modality for image guidance where we could actually target a lesion in the prostate. There's been some work with ultrasound, but unfortunately, the sensitivity is extremely poor for clinically significant prostate cancer. Now, with the advent of prostate MRI and multiparametric MRI, we've improved tremendously in our ability to actually image the prostate and find lesions in the prostate. It's not perfect, but it's really been a huge breakthrough. And so the first step was to do MRI-guided biopsies, where we can see a lesion, oftentimes missed on a truss biopsy, and then put a biopsy needle directly into it in order to get a sample. And there are many studies that show that, especially after a negative truss biopsy, an MRI plus a targeted biopsy leads to much better sensitivity for a clinically significant prostate cancer than just a repeat blind truss biopsy. Blind truss biopsies are non-targeted in the sense that they don't look to hit a particular lesion, but they are systematic and segmental in that they go through systematically through the prostate, but only a small portion of the prostate is sampled. So now there's MRI-guided focal laser ablation. There's also ultrasound or fusion-guided focal laser ablation. I want to make a brief distinction here, talking about the two guidance technologies. So there's the guidance technology, and then there's the actual ablation technology, the source of energy that causes tissue death. And there is such a thing as MRI-guided HIFU. There's ultrasound-guided HIFU. There's MRI-guided focal laser ablation. There's ultrasound-guided focal laser ablation. MRI guidance has tremendous advantages in that you can actually see the lesion directly with the MRI in real time. Also, MRI is able to measure temperature changes of the ablation tissue, of the tissue that you're trying to ablate in real time as you've turned on the laser and as you're doing the ablation. And what we found is that in some men, you need to increase the power of the laser to get it to the temperatures that you want. In other men, you don't want to turn the power of the laser on quite as high. And that real-time MRI feedback during the ablation helps us to do that. It helps us make those judgment calls. And it also helps us to create a structure of the ablation in such a way that we're able to get up to the capsule without extending beyond it. That's clearly the goal when you're trying to destroy a cancer that goes right up to the capsule without letting that ablation zone go beyond the capsule where it can hit the nerve. So now I'd like to speak mainly about MRI-guided focal laser ablation. The reason being there have been a couple studies with ultrasound or fusion-guided focal laser ablation. Unfortunately, the data on those patients, the short-term data in terms of oncological control is rather poor. When you have ultrasound-guided ablations, the current studies that have come out from the NIH and that have come out from UCLA show that a very significant portion of those patients have residual cancer that was not effectively treated. But I would attribute that not so much to the laser, but to the guidance technology. It's like sending a missile into destroy a target. The missile might offer a great explosion, but if the guidance doesn't take the missile to the target you're trying to hit, you're not going to destroy the target. And MRI offers tremendous advantages in using it in real time during the ablation.
If I may just quickly, so what you are talking about is what some of us would describe as in-bore laser ablation, correct? I just want to get that out there because that's a term that I think people have probably heard, but they may not have been fully aware what it meant.
No, and I appreciate that clarification. I have seen at least one urologist describe MRI, real-time MRI imaging guidance, but he actually meant fusion guidance. So it's important to make the distinction regarding from the perspective of a patient to ask, am I actually in an MRI during the procedure or not? Because really you need those MRI images to be acquired during the procedure in order to improve that level of precision. And so there are two main approaches. One is a transrectal approach where a guide is placed through the rectum in order to angle directly towards the cancer. Another option is a transperineal approach where the device is laid in the perineum, which is sort of the bottom part of the pelvis, and then guided into the prostate that way. Most practitioners are doing it transrectally. The distance to the lesion is shorter that way. It could be argued that it's a little bit easier to put the laser fiber precisely where you want it to go. But it's mainly based on operator experience. There are some other techniques that are used to try to minimize side effects, such as injecting a dilute amount of lidocaine or fluid around the nerve in order to provide some thermal protection of the nerve, so that when you ablate right up to the edge of the capsule, the fluid can absorb some of the extra heat that's coming off as opposed to the nerve absorbing it. When we do the ablation, the MRI in real time tells us what sort of temperature changes we're creating in the tissue. And then it also, at the end of the procedure, doing a contrast-enhanced MRI shows us whether or not we actually killed the region of tissue that we intended to. That's sort of the moment of truth, so to speak. So currently we have short-term data, and I know it's frustrating. Believe me, I'm looking forward to the long-term data being developed as well. And I tell every potential patient that we don't have long-term data showing, for example, improved overall survival versus, say, no treatment or comparing it to surgery. What we really need is a long-term trial that has patients, you know, that are prospectively randomized into different treatment arms, such as surgery, radiation, MRI-guided focal laser ablation, HIFU. The thing is, though, with low and intermediate risk prostate cancer, you really need 10 to 15 years to get good outcome or relevant outcome data. As a matter of fact, the PROTECT trial, which did this with radiation and surgery, just recently came out. And you know how long we've been treating patients with radical prostatectomies and radiation therapy. Also, another argument along these lines is that the first data that really showed that surgery had improved survival compared to no treatment wasn't published. The first prospective study that looked at that wasn't published until 2005. And at that point, I'm sure that there were many, I have an exact number, but I would guess that hundreds of thousands of radical prostatectomies had been performed prior to that sort of data being published. And so with any new treatment, you have to look at the short-term data, look at it with some, and you have to look at it with some reservation. And patients need to know that going into it so that they can make an informed decision themselves in terms of where they place.
Again, if I may, I mean, I think this is one of the issues that we're very interested in. Clearly, you know, we all understand that nobody's got even five-year data yet. But certainly some people must have two-year data by now, which would give you some idea about the risk for side effects and the risk for complications at the time of treatment. I personally am disturbed that those data haven't been published by anybody, because I know there are at least two physicians that could publish a series of data with that information.
That's correct. Let me comment on this. So, let me talk about what has been published. So, the largest studies to date for MRI-guided focal laser ablation have come out of NYU and the University of Chicago. Chicago's was up to 1 year. NYU's, they did a biopsy at 3 months after the focal laser ablation procedure. Now, in terms of side effects, the side effects are, if they don't occur within, most of the side effects occur close to immediately in the perioperative period. We haven't really seen delayed side effects that occur a year or 2 years out. And that's to be expected with this kind of technology. The safety profile for focal laser ablation, again, there have been multiple studies that have looked at the safety profile, which show that it has a fantastic safety profile, especially compared to the more traditional forms of treatment for prostate cancer. The question in my mind is, what is the long-term oncological control data going to show? The short-term oncological control data, for example, in the study from NYU, showed that after doing an MRI-guided re-biopsy of the lesion of ablation, showed that 96% of the time there wasn't residual cancer in the area of ablation. We're probably not going to be able to achieve those kind of results in the real world, but that gives you an initial sense of what the at least short-term efficacy of it is. And University of Chicago, in their study, they did a biopsy at 3 months and then at 12 months, and that showed not quite that level of control, but also very good short-term control in the zone of ablation.
Were these in patients with known clinically significant disease, or were these in patients who we might be looking at today and saying, well, they should be on active surveillance anyway?
Well, the NYU paper emphasized the point that 80% of the patients in their study would not fit the Johns Hopkins criteria for active surveillance.
Okay.
So we should talk about active surveillance a bit, because that really does play into this significantly. One of the big problems that we've had up to very recently is doing appropriate risk stratification. What do I mean by that? So there was a very nice long-term study out of Johns Hopkins that showed that if you have Gleason 6 disease, that really is Gleason 6 disease, your chance of dying from that are zero. There are a few scattered cases of Gleason 6 that has metastasized, but we're talking like much less than 0.1 of 1%. So if it really is pure Gleason 6 disease, then, you know, do you really need to treat it? Active surveillance is, in those cases, a very good option. The problem, though, is that, so with the Johns Hopkins study, they had the benefit of looking at all of these prostates, the whole gland, so they could determine that those Gleason 6 diagnoses really were Gleason 6 diagnoses. The problem in real life, though, is that you don't have a whole prostate to look at under a microscope when you need to counsel a patient regarding whether or not they should seek treatment. And that, again, goes to the point of risk stratification. If you have a patient who undergoes a TRUST biopsy, comes back with a Gleason 6, how sure are you that patient really only has Gleason 6 disease? There have been a variety of studies on this. Most of the data ranges between 30% and 70% in terms of patients who originally had a diagnosis of Gleason 6, what percentage of them were upgraded at surgery? What percentage of them actually had Gleason 7 disease, but thought they only had Gleason 6 disease based on the TRUST biopsy? Well, since about half, one of the arguments that urologists have made, and, you know, with some degree of, with some reason to it, is that, well, if you have a 6 on a TRUST biopsy and you actually have a 50% chance of having a Gleason 7, should we proceed with a radical prostatectomy? Now, that's led to a tremendous amount of over-treatment. And so one of the tools that we've been using to minimize that is MRI with a fusion or an MRI in-bore biopsy in order to better risk stratify those patients. So that way we can have a higher degree of confidence that a patient who has a Gleason 6 diagnosis really only has Gleason 6 disease. And then with greater confidence, we can recommend active surveillance. Or they, you know, if they have a Gleason 6, the MRI shows something significant elsewhere in the prostate, get a targeted biopsy, and let's look at that other sample. And if that turns out to be, you know, a Gleason 4 plus 3, well, then active surveillance wouldn't be appropriate. And so MRI has, just to summarize, MRI has really advanced risk stratification and then focal treatment. It's really enabled that.
So would I be right in thinking that all of the patients who come to you asking about FLA, if they have Gleason 7, you will do it, assuming that it's a relatively small amount of Gleason 7, And if it's Gleason 6, you will say to them, well, let's make sure that you aren't really Gleason 7 and do a repeat biopsy under MRI guidance of some type.
Well, it gets a little bit complicated. If a patient wants to, a lot of it, also taking into consideration, a lot of it comes down to patient preferences. I can make my recommendations, but the decisions really come down to the patient. So if I have a patient who has a Gleason 6, that small volume on truss, gets an MRI, the MRI is negative, I'll definitely recommend active surveillance. If the patient has a small volume or has a Gleason 6 on truss biopsy, gets the MRI, and the MRI shows a lesion that corresponds to the Gleason 6 seen on pathology, then I'll tell them, look, active surveillance might be a very good option for you. Let's talk about it. And if they say that, you know, they really would like to active surveillance is a good option for them and that's what they'd like, I look at the pathology and see if it matches up with the MRI. If it matches up and the MRI isn't too suspicious, you know, okay, let's leave it alone, get a repeat PSA MRI, you know, in a year. If the MRI looks like it's more suspicious than the pathology would, than the pathology results from the truss biopsy would indicate, then I'll tell them, you know, we should proceed with an image-guided biopsy, and I would recommend fusion or in-bore, depending on whether or not I think the fusion biopsy would be able to hit that lesion, because there is some misregistration with fusion versus, say, an in-bore biopsy.
So that would be a patient with a PI-RADS score of 3, right, or higher, right?
PI-RADS would definitely be 3 or higher. But it gets a little bit more complicated than that. PI-RADS really is a simplification of findings.
Sure.
So now, if a patient, so if, let's say a patient comes with a Gleason 3 plus 4 that's 30% Gleason 4 and has, you know, 1 centimeter of length on the biopsy, and has a concordant MRI lesion, and it all fits together appropriately, then I'll offer them MRI-guided focal laser ablation. There are patients who have a Gleason 6 disease and tell me, look, I need treatment. I cannot go without treatment, you know. And I'll push active surveillance, but patients will push back. And, you know, one of my patients recently told me, look, if you don't do focal laser ablation, I'm going to go have surgery. You know, I can't leave that inside of me. In those patients, I will agree to do an MRI-guided focal laser ablation. So we should move on to talk about what patients are good candidates for focal laser ablation.
Sure.
So, the ideal patient, I love it when I get these ones because it's straightforward, technically easy, and you know we've noticed in that we get good oncological control on these patients. An 8-millimeter single focus of Gleason 7 that has a good amount of distance between the neurovascular bundle and the edge of the lesion. By a good amount of distance, I'd say maybe a centimeter. Those patients are fantastic candidates, especially if the rest of the if the quality of the MRI is great and there isn't much confounding on the rest of the prostate. If the rest of the prostate looks clear and we can see things clearly on the MRI, I love taking care of those little guys. Now, you can also ablate 2 separate foci, maybe 3. That's pushing it. Beyond that, or if there's diffuse disease, then I tell patients that they're not good candidates for focal laser ablation. And obviously I talk to all patients about a variety of alternatives. But with patients who have diffuse disease or really tremendous multifocal disease, I would decline to do a focal laser ablation. So if I may, when you've
got a patient with two foci like that, are you more comfortable if they're both in one lobe of the prostate or both in one quadrant of the prostate? I mean, in other words, how we obviously all worry that this can be disseminated disease, even though, you know, it's a multifocal disease, even though one can only see one or two small foci. How much confidence do you get from the sort of the positioning of the of two foci as opposed to one?
Sure. So if they're right next to each other, then I take out that whole area. If they're separate from each other, then I take out the one with plus a margin, I take out the other one plus a margin. It's technically a little bit easier to do them if they're next to each other, but either way, it doesn't make a tremendous difference whether they're in separate lobes or if they're right next to each other, so long as the morphology, the size, the characteristics of the lesions are favorable, then it doesn't make a tremendous difference whether they're in one lobe or two lobes. The issue does come in where I've seen, unfortunately, where there's a lesion in the peripheral zone next to the neurovascular bundle, one on each side, and that significantly increases the risk of having sexual side effects. If you have to ablate right up to both nerves, your risk of sexual side effects does go up, and that's where it becomes an issue.
And would you usually be able to tell patients beforehand that that might be a problem?
Always.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Let me just briefly talk about, as a clarification point, there is green light laser for prostate. That's completely different. Green light laser is used through the urethra. It goes into the penis, goes to the prostate with a camera, and the urologist cuts out chunks of prostate tissue in order to improve the symptoms of BPH. That's completely different than MRI-guided focal laser ablation for prostate cancer.
So to summarize, basically what you're telling us, I think, is that by doing in-bore FLA, you are, A, able to help the patient by using what you believe to be a less invasive technique that, as far as you are aware, the short-term outcomes are pretty good for most patients, but clearly we're going to need long-term data. And I get the impression you are saying that you believe that the in-bore technique is a great deal more effective than truss MRI fusion-guided FLA. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, tremendously more effective because you can target the lesion directly, measure temperature changes as you're doing the ablation, and you can do a post-treatment MRI that's contrast enhanced to see the effectiveness of the ablation itself directly.
So the language that people use to talk about techniques that are in this stage of evolution is obviously important because payers will currently be classifying this technique, I believe, as experimental. People like me tend to use the word investigational. I don't think anybody's going to be saying that you know, this is a fully validated way to treat prostate cancer yet, but certainly it's very attractive to a lot of men because they think of it as lumpectomy or the equivalent of lumpectomy for prostate cancer. And I worry about, and I don't mean this unkindly, but I worry about, you know, the skill levels of the people who may be offering this at the moment and how a patient is able to get some clarity about that. I mean, for example, how many patients have you personally treated this way yet?
Sure, 42.
Okay.
And I know that's not a tremendous number like 500 is, but I did complete a fellowship in interventional radiology, and I've done cryoablations for renal cancers, microwave ablations for liver cancers. I've done easily over 1,000 types of 1,000 interventional radiology procedures, and one of the benefits of the MRI guidance is it gives you very real-time feedback in terms of the quality of the work that you're doing. So if you're a good prostate diagnostic radiologist and can see what you were able to accomplish or what you may not have done as well as you would have liked to, if you're able to see that immediately, then that gives you real-time feedback in order to accelerate your understanding and skill level much more quickly. The people who are doing this at volume currently are, it takes a great deal of skill to be able to do this well. And so I do understand the reservations of, being a new technique. I wouldn't hesitate to have a patient go to, whether it's Dr. Walzer or Dr. Feller or Dr. Sperling or to myself, I would feel comfortable sending a patient to any of those practitioners for this.
My understanding is nobody's done 500 patients as yet. My understanding was Dr. Walzer might have done a couple of hundred himself by now. Is that about right?
Yes, Dr. Walzer's done roughly around 220, plus or minus 10 or 15. Dr. Sperling reports that he's done more than 500. Dr. Feller in California, I don't know the exact number that he's done, but it's definitely over 100.
Okay. So, Jim, I know you had some questions about this because you've talked to patients who have had problems after FLA, so perhaps you've got a couple of questions for Dr. Karamanian.
Yeah, certainly. Dr. Karamanian, you did a great job of explaining all this to people who really don't know the intricacies like me, me being a HIFU guy. But what I'm hearing from a patient's point of view and looking in the blogs is there's a problem with not everybody's like you, and there are people who misread the MRI, and they misread the targeted area, the dark spot, and they treat that, and they miss tissue, and they've missed. I'd like to know from you too. After I'm done here, I have two questions. How often are people retreated because there was tissue missed in the original MRI? Number one. What percentage of patients for these gentlemen, these doctors you worked with, had infections? Because that is another issue. There have been urologists who all of a sudden get this patient in their office who has infection from an FLA, and the person treating him, the FLA doctor, wasn't prepared for the long-term dealing with that patient in their business. There's also been I don't know these for facts, but I've heard complaints of recurrence. And I've also heard concerns about damage to the tissue walls. So these are areas from a patient's point of view that I've personally heard, and I'm not an expert enough to explain it like you are.
No, and I appreciate those questions. I'm going to try to address them one by one, but if I forget one, please do remind me so I address that one as well. So in terms of infection, let me make one comment to address a previous question from Mike a little bit earlier and tie that into this as well. So I trained under Dr. Walzer at University of Texas Medical Branch, and we do have data that that we're looking to publish within, hopefully the next 6 months that will add, more patients to the knowledge database and the literature. One of the problems that we've had is that it's very hard to the company that makes the laser really hasn't supported it at all in the field of prostate, and so all of the effort and really falls onto us to try to compile all this, and it takes a tremendous amount of work in order to do this in a rigorous manner. So we are looking to get that data published within hopefully the next 6 months or so. So stay tuned. And I'm going to speak to some of our experiences, although the data hasn't been published yet. So I wanted to mention that. So you know where I'm coming from when I address some of your questions. So in terms of infection, We've actually found that with focal laser ablation, there's less of a risk of serious infection than a truss biopsy. I'm not ready to quote exact numbers for you yet, but I think there's a good reason why that is, intuitively. So when you put, yes, you use a transrectal approach, except for University of Chicago uses a transperineal approach. Everybody else that I'm aware of uses a transrectal approach. Yes, it does use that same transrectal approach that has a risk of infection associated with it. Some of the things we do to minimize those risks are we provide enemas. We have an enema the evening before, the morning of the procedure, dual antibiotic coverage. But fundamentally, one of the main differences with an FLA versus a truss biopsy or a prostate biopsy is that one, you imagine you're taking that tiny laser fiber, inserting it through the rectum into the prostate, and you drag some bacteria with it. Well, what happens when you turn on that laser and it reaches 60 degrees Celsius or higher? Often 60 is sort of one of the cutoffs we use, but usually the temperature gets up to about 80 degrees Celsius. That bacteria won't survive 80 degrees Celsius. Now, what can happen, though, is as the you can immediately kill that tissue and the bacteria with it, but as the tissue is getting reabsorbed from the body, anytime you have tissue that's not vascularized, that's not viable tissue, it's at risk of getting infected. And so we have seen some delayed infections that come from focal laser ablation. We haven't, in my experience and to my knowledge, I'm not aware of a patient who's needed to be hospitalized for an infection after FLA. It's possible that there's one out there, or it's possible that there are a couple out there that I'm not aware of. But even if there are two, let's say, just making up a number, let's say there are two patients who needed to be hospitalized for an infection after a focal laser ablation, that would still put the number less than truss biopsies. Now, there are patients who do, now, that's sepsis. That's a patient who has a very serious infection of the after focal laser ablation. There are patients who do develop infections that are less significant than sepsis, and to date, all the ones that I'm aware of have been successfully treated with oral antibiotics. Regarding the practitioner managing a patient who has an infection, I mean, absolutely, the physician who does the procedure should be able to provide that sort of longitudinal care. That's one of the things that is one of the pieces of core training for me as an interventional radiologist, to be able to not just to be a technician, but to see the patient, evaluate them, understand all the different facets of the different treatment modalities, be able to counsel the patient on those in order to explain the risks, benefits, and alternatives of the treatment that we're offering, and then to be able to manage your own complications afterwards. Now, there are, it can become a challenge when, for example, a patient flies back to, you know, let's say a patient comes to Texas, gets treated here, flies back, you know, to the state that they're from. Managing that infection across, you know, a long distance, it would probably be better in those cases for a local physician to prescribe the antibiotics in consultation with the physician who did the procedure. But the physician who did the procedure should definitely be part of the team who's taking care of that patient. And if the patient's local and they're responding appropriately to the antibiotic therapy, then there's no need to get somebody else involved. If, for example, though, there's a serious complication, then, and I'm just speaking in general now, if there is a serious complication, then it's appropriate to bring in physicians of different specialties who can provide advanced subspecialty care. Did I sort of address your questions?
Yeah, you did. I just think there's gaps. I don't want to be too critical here, but, you know, you can hear from what professionals tell you, and then you go and see the people's actual comments on multiple sites, and, you know, it brings to question long-term credibility. And of course, for HIFU has compromised credibility so far, be long term, and so does FLA, is infancy. But there's also pilot error. And I don't mean to be rude by saying this, but there are guys who just say their doctor screwed up, because there's a very steep learning curve in your business with FLA or HIFU or Da Vinci. So just from my point of view, I'm trying to meander through the parts about this isn't just about you as a professional. This is about your industry laterally. Do these other physicians have the same passion for excellence that you do? And we've already seen, of course, that that is compromised in some people's practices. So I just, there's too many, like Mike has said, there's too many incomplete things here that make it compelling. I also am troubled by some of these patients that are treated and they don't need to be, and you know that you've already shared that they're good candidates for active surveillance, but they want to just get rid of the cancer. And that's happening with overtreatment in multiple treatments across the country here, which is troubling. But FLA is so controlling for a small spot. How do you deal with a tiny thread that you're going to miss? The MRI that you read, or not you read, somebody else doesn't know how to read the MRI, so they miss a tiny thread of tissue, and they have to get retreated again. How often does that happen?
Well, I can tell you that before, and that's, so let me tie this in as well to a different, another concept, because I think it's very relevant here. MRI-guided procedures should really, in my opinion, be done with those who have advanced training in using advanced imaging modalities to do procedures, and that really is interventional radiologists. And the one of the big advantages that an interventional radiologist can bring to the table, who's also a very good prostate imager, is they can look at the MRIs themselves and see subtle nuances that aren't necessarily going to be reported or even seen by somebody who doesn't read a whole lot of prostate MRIs or isn't, you know, very experienced in prostate MRI. And so I take full responsibility. I review every MRI, very carefully before I would consider doing an MRI-guided focal laser ablation on a patient. Believe me, I do not rely on the reports from other physicians before I do this. And it's the same thing before when I would do a microwave ablation for a liver or a chemoembolization for a liver cancer. You have to review the images yourself and really understand what it is you're seeing, what it is you're treating. There's no substitute for that. And so it's incumbent upon the treating physician to be able to do that.
Is there any discussion going on between the societies about what the skill levels and qualifications should be for people who are practicing this sort of technique? I mean, I realize this is always very complicated, but I mean, in the end, it's the profession that has to take responsibility for the quality of the practice.
Well, so yes and no. It's a little more complicated politically. So, by the way, first of all, there was a meeting yesterday in Chicago that I was happy to be a part of, where some of us who perform MRI-guided focal laser ablation, you know, met and discussed some of the issues that are facing this technology. I spoke to the company that makes the laser fiber, and I asked one of the representatives if there's somebody who, let's say they've never done a focal laser ablation case before, let's say they've done two, you know, would you sell them the equipment to do this? And they said yes, they would. For me, that's frustrating, because you want to have quality control there and only allow people who have demonstrated a high skill level in operating to be able to do this. Sadly, you know, as a physician, I've also seen surgeons who operate at low skill levels, you know, hurt a number of patients. Unfortunately, there isn't a good mechanism to be able to prevent people who, you know, I mean, who's going to play judge here, you know? How do you begin to set up that sort of regulatory system?
Oh, no, I understand. I mean, it's one of the things I always say to all patients. I mean, every surgeon has to do his first radical prostatectomy, and every interventional radiologist who wants to practice FLA is presumably going to do his first FLA on somebody. This is a constant problem. But I do think, you know, there's an obligation on us all to try to help to give guidance as to what is acceptable in terms of the training and the practice using these techniques. Now, I don't want to belabor this because I want to move on. Tony, do you think there is any hope of anybody actually being able to do randomized trials for this kind of thing?
No, I think that Dr. Karamanian pointed out very, very clearly that doing comparative trials from the different modalities that are out there are going to be long-term, they're going to be very expensive, they're going to be very difficult to accomplish. If there's a way to do a clinical trial, I think it could be used well with a subset, like a what you call secondary endpoints, would be to go ahead and take a patient who's made a decision that they're going to have surgery, that it's their decision to go ahead and have surgery, and possibly do the procedure ahead of that surgery so that you can gauge what was seen in the MRI versus what was seen in the actual prostate, total prostate biopsy. I think the doctor would probably agree with that. And by the way, hi again, Dr. Karamanian. You and I spoke for over an hour about this in early September. Really enjoyed all the paperwork you sent me on this. But that would be my suggestion. If we're going to see a clinical trial on this, it's going to have to go in the direction of maybe a subset trial to which this procedure can be piggybacked onto it to compare the MRI of efficacy versus the actual disease in the prostate. Your thoughts, doctor?
Oh, I think that's brilliant. I just wish I could get Medtronic to pay for that kind of study. you know, I would love to do that. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you how much I'd love to be able to do that kind of study. The problem is, these things are expensive. You know, how do you get NIH funding has really tightened up these last several years. It's hard to get funding for this kind of study, but I think that would be fantastic. Now, but you know what's going to happen is you're going to have, even after that kind of study, you're going to say, okay, well, we don't see any clinically significant prostate cancer left, but does that really mean that the patient is going to live longer? Well, again, you still need the 15-year outcome data, and there are still going to be people who criticize it. But there have been some studies that show that where patients who are already going to undergo radical prostatectomy, who did undergo focal laser ablation, but just to test the ablation modality, it did show that there was confluent ablation, confluent cell death in the zone of ablation. And so that's encouraging. The issue then is going to go back to the multifocality question. May I make a few comments about the multifocality question?
Well, I'd love to do that, but we've got one more person. I want to see if she has any questions, and then I want to see if we can get some of the questions in from some of the people on the line.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Jan, do you have a quick question?
I do. You know, I think for the listeners, patients listening, I think it's important to talk quickly about cost and the fact that this is probably not covered by insurance. So the two ways, if I'm not mistaken, that you can access focal laser ablation or most focal therapies is, number one, paying for it cash. And if I understand correct, is it $20,000 or more, Dr. Karamanian?
Yes, I've seen $20,000 to $32,000 being the range.
Okay. So certainly that's something that you need to understand and ask up front. But the second place would be actually in a clinical trial. And I did look online, and I found three right now. One's at NIH, one's at Mayo Clinic, and one's at Indian Wells with Dr. Feller. So I wonder if that's even a safer setting. You would get better monitoring. I don't know, just a thought. But I think it's important to understand it's not covered by insurance, so the way you're going to access it is paying a large amount of cash or finding a clinical trial.
Well, let me comment on that. So First, the NIH trial is with fusion, not MRI guidance.
Okay.
And fusion guidance, there are reasons why they're trying to demonstrate this with fusion guidance, but again, I would caution anybody from doing fusion-guided FLA. The outcome data has been bad and with good reason. And
okay.
Then Indian, by the way, Dr. Feller with Indian Wells, he's definitely doing the most rigorous clinical study on focal laser ablation, where he does an MRI-guided biopsy before and after every patient who's getting who's undergoing FLA. But the trial isn't funded, so patients still have to pay out of pocket. And I'm not sure about the Mayo study,
okay.
But I believe that that's patients also have to pay out of pocket for that
so
trial as well.
So they should ask, even though it's a trial.
Yes.
They should ask. Okay, that's helpful.
Sure.
Okay, so what I'd like to do now is take a few minutes and hand us back to Priya to see if you've got questions from the audience for you, Dr. Karamanian. I know there are always a lot of things one can get to on these calls, but we do like to see what we can do for the patients who are on the line and have questions to ask you. So, Priya, would you like to take over again?
Thank you, Mike. We have been receiving questions on our website, actually. Dr. Karamanian. So I'll just quickly go through them. Some of them we have already answered through our discussion. The first one is, given that one has a 3 Tesla MRI showing the lesion, does it make sense to do an FLA without a biopsy first or to do the biopsy at the same time and get the results a few days later? Or is the biopsy result important prior to the FLA? That's from Ed.
Sure. It's important to have the biopsy result prior to the FLA. And the reason is, there are many reasons. So let's say that it really turns out to be a low-volume Gleason 6 or even a moderate-volume Gleason 6, but only Gleason 6. Then the patient needs to, you know, not while they're on a procedural table and sedated, but while they have their thoughts clear and collected and they can think clearly, and really evaluate, okay, do I want a treatment or do I want to just stay on active surveillance? They need to be able to make that decision, and what you can't do if you biopsy and ablate immediately. Another thing is that, let's say it turns out to be a Gleason 9 and the patient is, you know, 55 and has a life expectancy apart from the prostate cancer of more than 30 years. That's going to be a patient where that should undergo more aggressive therapy. And so it's important to be able to tailor the treatment to the patient, which you can't do until you have the pathology results.
So are you telling me you would never do this on a patient with a Gleason 9?
I would never do this on a young patient with a Gleason 9 who has a long life expectancy. Now, when I say never, I mean with given the current data. If we 20 years from now, I might, depending on what the data shows. But and the reason is that Gleason 9 has Gleason component 5 inside of it, and those cancers can really spread in a way that you can't see well with MRI. And so, if I don't feel comfortable that I can ablate the index lesion plus a margin, then I don't want to. I don't want to treat the patient. A high-risk disease needs aggressive therapy, not intermediately aggressive therapy like FLA, or not no therapy like active surveillance. Aggressive disease needs aggressive therapy.
Thank you. Next question,
please. Thank you, doctor. The next one is, what is the accuracy of 3 TMP MRI for lesion size? How small a lesion can be detected?
Well, so that goes an important part of that is answering that question is the quality of the imaging at the center. So the better the quality of the imaging, the smaller the lesions you can see. But less than 5 millimeters, it's tough for a 3T multiparametric MRI to pick up a lesion that's less than 5 millimeters. Now, having said that, what are the chances that a lesion that's less than 5 millimeters is going to actually become clinical disease? Well, maybe at some point in the future, but we would be able to pick it up as it grows. So there are small cancers and definitely small Gleason 6s that 3T MPMRI will miss. But I would argue if a patient has a 3 millimeter a 3-millimeter Gleason 6, you shouldn't even treat it. So who cares if you don't see it? If they have, you know, a 3-millimeter Gleason 7 cancer, it's probably going to grow to the point where you can see it on the MRI before before anything bad happens. Now, having said that, we do know that, you know, that MRI for the prostate is not 100%. But there's only one test that's really 100% for prostate cancer, and that's a radical prostatectomy. But obviously that's far and away overkill as a diagnostic modality. One of the great things about multiparametric MRI is it tends to miss clinically insignificant cancers, and it's very sensitive for clinically significant cancers. But if the MRI is negative and a patient is in a high-risk clinical scenario, they should still undergo a blind trust biopsy.
Thank you, Doctor. Now, there's another question. What role does PSA testing play post-FLA? Also, what type of increase should be expected over time?
Sure. So what we found is that the PSA drops at the first measurement post-FLA, which is usually done at 6 months, and then it usually stabilizes at about a year, and then between year one and year two. Now, if what we found is that when it drops to less than 30% of its original value, the chances of having residual or recurrent disease is extremely low. When it drops at 50% of the original level, then there's still a very low risk of residual disease. What we do is we use PSA in order to track. I mean, just like you use PSA after radiation or after surgery, if it starts to go up and if it goes above the pre-ablation number, then we're worried whether or not we see anything on the MRI.
Thank you, Doctor. Next question is, what are the chances of patients losing sexual function as a result of this procedure? And once it's lost, are there ways to recover it? Yeah.
Sure. So if there's bilateral disease where it's going right up to the neurovascular bundle on each side and the nerve is right against the capsule, you know, then the patients are at a higher risk of having erectile dysfunction. Overall, the risk is of developing impotence from this procedure is less than 10%. With patients who have cancer that's unilateral and not going right up against the nerve, the chance of having any effect on sexual function is going to be very low. Having a significant impact on sexual function is going to be, the risk is very low in those patients. We do know of a phenomenon where the nerve can sort of be stunned, and then the patients will regain where they'll have a drop in their erectile function immediately after the procedure, and then over the course of a few months, it'll come back. Let me try to be a little more clear. When a patient has sexual problems after focal laser ablation, it's immediately apparent within the few weeks after the procedure. It does tend to come back to varying degrees over the course of a year or two with patients, but again, that's going to be the small minority of patients who deal with significant sexual problems after focal laser ablation. One of the things we do is we also supplement patients with Cialis to try to improve that function as needed.
Is that an age-related effect, or is there no real sort of indicator of heightened risk?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Is that in any way related to the patient's age or anything else? I mean, in other words, do you have any ideas about why some patients are at greater risk than others?
Yes. So for cancers that are right next to the neurovascular bundle where you're ablating right up to the nerve, that's a risk factor. Having bilateral disease in a problematic area is a risk factor. And yes, older patients tend to have lower baseline sexual erectile function. And so the lower a patient is starting off, the more at risk that a little bit of a hit will have a significant impact in terms of their sexual function.
Thank you.
So, you know, a 55-year-old who has fantastic sexual function and you singe the nerve a little bit, if you irritate the nerve a little bit, oftentimes wouldn't notice any impact.
So I don't know if you think we have time for one more question, Priya?
I think that's all the questions that we have from the listeners as of now. Mike, if you have
okay.
a question, we do have a minute more.
No, I think I just want to thank Dr. Karamanian for his time. I think this has been a very helpful introduction for a lot of people. We all understand that new techniques take time to prove themselves. As I think I've said to you in a couple of emails, I encourage you to encourage your colleagues to publish as much as they can, as fast as they can, because I think that will only help everybody to understand what the opportunities are here.
I agree 100%, and believe me, I'm making efforts along those. I'm trying to make it happen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Before we wrap up the session, I'd like to inform everybody that Prostate Cancer International is conducting a one-day conference on March 4th for patients and caregivers. Both Mike and Jan are going to be there moderating sessions. Jan, would you like to say something on this?
Yeah, it's in Southwest Florida, and it should be a great conference. The intention is to just serve people and help them. There will be a lot of Q&A, a lot of networking, and I think it'll be a great conference. So we're asking for a $25 donation, but if you don't have the $25, you get in free. We won't turn anybody away.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Karamanian. It was a great informative session, as Mike just mentioned, and I hope this treatment picks up soon and helps a lot of people. Mike, Tony, Jim, and Jan, thanks so much for your participation. And the talk is going to be put up on CureTalks blog's website for playback along with its transcript. Please visit curetalks.com for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Priya.
Thank
Good
you.
Night.
Bye-bye.
Night.
Good night.
Yep. Yeah.